Scripture reading is from 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 18 through 25. For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God, and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men.
O come, thou wisdom from on high, and order all things far and to us the path of knowledge show, and cause us in her ways to go. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel.
Here in December, we are centering our thoughts, our meditations on that beautiful and ancient hymn, O Come Emmanuel. And we have used a title of Christ from each of the verses that are in our Baptist hymnal. Now, I will tell you, if you were to search the internet, or if you go to a friend's church who's Presbyterian or Methodist, you may see different verses. There are many, many different verses, and this is one of the oldest hymns that is in most of our hymnals. Some dated as far back as the 7th century. The strongest evidence has it for the 12th century. But we looked at what Emmanuel means. We looked at what we mean by come thou day spring, come and cheer our spirits by thine advent here. Then today we are looking at that third verse, O come thou wisdom from on high, the wisdom of God. What is it that we mean when we refer to Christ as the wisdom of God? One evening, I was in traffic with my children in Nashville traffic, and you know there are pleasant thoughts that come through your mind already. Traffic is really good for your spiritual well-being, isn't it? You just meditate, and you feel the glory of God, and the good and sanctified thoughts just flood your mind during rush hour. Well, I'm sitting in traffic as I'm trying to get from 65 up on to 440 as I'm going into West Nashville to the what was then Welch College on West End Avenue. And my children are in the back whining at me, because they noticed that the lanes to the left are going fast. And we're stuck in traffic. And they, in their infinite wisdom, said, Dad, 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 let's go in that lane. Let's go in that lane. I was like, well, that's all well and good, but where we're going is in this lane. And then in a smart-aleck voice, I started chiding them and saying, oh, we were going to West End. We went to Hendersonville, but we got there fast. And then I made it even worse and said, oh, we were going to Louisville, but we went to Birmingham, but we got there fast. You know, there's a correlation between traffic and the wisdom of men. Because a lot of people are going to the wrong place, but they're going there very fast. And the things that God considers to be wise, and He designed for us to understand and for us to follow, and those things that man considers to be wise, have been at odds for many, many years. So when God, through Jesus, sends the person of His wisdom, we saw in Jesus, and as we read the recorded account, we see in Jesus the wisdom from on high. Now, wisdom is very important to God, and it is so important that He wrote an entire book called Proverbs, where the whole thing just talks about wisdom, wisdom, wisdom. And there's some very practical nuggets that are in there. Don't get drunk. Very, very, very practical. Don't follow, how do you say this properly in a mixed congregation? Don't follow the wayward woman. Or ladies, don't follow the wayward man. I always had that. I've always had a grudge. It seemed like all the girls wanted the bad boys. And I was like, why? But wisdom is very important to God, and so important that in chapter 8 of Proverbs, the writer, primarily Solomon, the writer personifies wisdom, and the voice of the narration of chapter 8 is wisdom speaking to us. And so in Proverbs 8, here's wisdom speaking. Wisdom says, "The Lord possessed me at the beginning of His work, the first of His acts of old. Ages ago I was set up. At the first, before the beginning of the earth, when there were no depths, I was brought forth, when there were no springs abounding with water, before the mountains had been shaped, before the hills, I was brought forth, before He had made the earth with its field, or the first of the dust of the world, when He established the heavens, I was there. When He drew a circle on the face of the deep, when He made firm the skies above, when He established the fountains of the deep, when He assigned the sea its limit so that the waters might not transgress His command, when He marked out the foundations of the earth, then I was beside Him like a master workman, and I was the delight of His day, rejoicing before Him always, rejoicing in His inhabited world and delighting in the children of man." But as the years went on, we saw that man deviated from God's prescribed path of wisdom. And there was something in us that we inherited from Adam that drifts us from God's design for us. And God tells us in Isaiah 55 through the prophet Isaiah, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." As the Apostle Paul begins to write, he begins to issue a judgment on what man considers to be wise. Because if you read periodicals, newspapers, magazines, watch the TV shows and documentaries of the 21st century, you see that we think well of ourselves. We think that our way is the best way, and everybody who disagrees with our way in the 21st century American point of view, that they're just wrong and they're probably evil people. But God says in Romans chapter 1, claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. And in Paul's day, he's speaking of people who have exchanged the glory of God that shows itself in God's creation, and instead of worshiping the Creator, they turn and worship the rocks and the trees and the animals that God has created. In our day, we have reasoned God out of philosophy and science. And it's one thing that Christians sometimes in their reaction to that become anti-intellectual, as if all knowledge, the pursuit of knowledge, is evil in itself, and we then make ourselves to be the butt of jokes because we won't think. Christians are called to think. But we are called to think by God's ways. And in our thinking, we can encounter, we can debate, we can reason with people. That does not mean that they're going to accept our reasoning, but that we can take the ideas and the philosophies of man and we can reverse engineer them. We can show, here's why you came to this conclusion, and here's where that will ultimately lead. Let me show you what God proposes and why that is going to be good. But those two paths of wisdom are at odds more now than they have ever been. Speaking of God's wisdom, Paul eventually erupts into praise in Romans chapter 11. This is the end of what we would call the doctrinal section. And by the way, I know that some of you that are in Brian's class, you've spent a good bit of time recently in Romans. And as the Lord willing, we're going to spend about the first half of next year, of this coming year, preaching through the book of Romans. So you should know Romans before it's all over, okay? But at the end of what we would call the doctrinal section of Romans, in Romans chapter 11, Paul writes, "Oh, the depth of the riches and wisdom and knowledge of God! How unsearchable are His judgments and how inscrutable His ways! For who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has been His counselor? Or who has given a gift to Him that He might be repaid? For from Him and through Him and to Him are all things. To Him be glory forever. Amen." And then Paul continues with as he gets to 1 Corinthians, he's again engaging a Greek and Jewish culture. The church that was started there had a combination of both Gentiles and Jews. And you see that in areas like Athens, like Rome, like Corinth. And you will have people in that congregation. Some of them had grown up, proper Jewish people. And our churches, we have a similarity. We have some people that they grew up, Southern Baptist, the way, the bride. We've got it all right, And there's some people in the church that have grown up there. They are familiar with the way we do things. You got Annie Armstrong at this time of year. You got Lottie Moon at this time of year. You just go ahead. You know when to fill those checks out. Then you get people that come to Christ, and they're just as saved as those that grew up in the church. but they didn't grow up with the same training. The terms are new to them. They're just as much the people of God, but they come with some baggage. Now, let me stop this here because this is not the main point of the message today, but brothers and sisters, it is by the grace of God that we get to deal with baggage. Because when people come to Christ, their sins are forgiven, but they still got scars, they still got problems, they still got baggage. And it is the delight of the people of God to get to incorporate all our baggage together and try to help one another with it. And by the time we grow in Christ, the bags get lighter and we start setting some things aside that should have been set aside long ago. We forgive people that should have been forgiven. We deal with problems, we deal with pain, and we start growing together. But sometimes in the process, there's friction within the church. And the people in Corinth especially felt that. We were trained in seminary. Do not preach through 1 and 2 Corinthians until you're ready to leave a church. Because it stirs stuff up. People get mad. There's an old saying, preacher, you stepped on my toes. Well, 1 Corinthians steps on all of you. All of everything that we are. It just knocks us down. But he deals with it. Paul has this way of weaving between the philosophical and the practical in a seamless drive. And what Jess read to you this morning is one of those where Paul uses a wisdom, foolishness motif. And he kind of oscillates between what wisdom means and what foolishness means. And he'll take that and he holds it up to us like a Rubik's Cube, and he kind of turns it over and says, look what this side, or look at it from this angle, look at it from that angle. And as he develops that in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, he's setting the stage for everything else he's going to do. And he talks about God from Isaiah 29. He says, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. This is not God's declaration of war against wisdom. This is God's declaration against war, of war against false wisdom. But if you're speaking in human terms, yeah, I'm going to knock their wisdom down, the wisdom of the wise. He uses wise or the wise, the wisdom. He uses that word or some form of it 7 or 8 times. I say 7 or 8, not because I have trouble counting, but because at one point he says, the wisdom of the wise. And if you want to call that one occurrence or two, it depends. But that occurs 7 or 8 times, depending on how you want to count that. And then foolish or folly or foolishness occurs 5 times. And so he goes back and forth, and he's showing us this dual theme. And the way that he's using wisdom and folly in this passage, it's the same coin. He's just showing you 2 different sides of that coin. So when he comes away, he talks about the foolishness of the cross. Well, the foolishness of the cross is not foolish. Why would he call the cross foolishness? Because it's foolish to people. You don't know how foolish the cross is in man's way of thinking? The Jews didn't like the cross because they anticipated a Messiah that would come and deliver them politically and militarily. That's the way people think. The Greeks didn't like it, abhorred the flesh. When Paul in Acts chapter 17 is preaching in Athens, he speaks to a group of philosophers in the Areopagus, and as he's speaking, they're with him. To tell you the truth, they're even with him for the crucifixion. But when Paul speaks of the cross of Christ, he's talking about the full event. The full event of the cross is the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. That's what Paul is referring to by the cross. The Greeks didn't have a problem with the Messiah dying because in their Stoic and Epicurean philosophies, you want to separate in a... I'm not going to get into Platonism, but they wanted to separate from the flesh, to put it down. And if you could ultimately get yourself away from the corruption of the flesh, you will have achieved the higher state. The problem that the Greeks had was not with the death of Christ. The problems that the Greeks had was with the resurrection of Christ. Not because they didn't think it was possible, they didn't think it was desirable. That's why when Paul, if you'll read Paul's sermon in Acts chapter 17, he makes contact with them. He instead of starting with Abraham, where he usually starts, he started with creation. They didn't have a problem with creation. Then he talks about God being the Father of all people. They didn't have a problem with that. He even talks about him sending this special person, Jesus. They don't have a problem with that. He speaks of Jesus dying. They don't have a problem with that. But when he speaks of the resurrection, the place goes nuts. Have you ever watched BBC or the British Parliament when somebody says something and they all start yelling at the same time? That's the Areopagus at that moment. And maybe they're speaking in British accents and speaking in Greek. I don't know. It just seems it's very contentious, very, very argumentative at that point because they don't like the resurrection. It's stupid. It's foolish. Why would you have distanced yourself, you've separated yourself from the physicality of this world, why would you come back to it in resurrection? It's foolishness to them. But he said, those of us who are being saved. There's something that you catch in some of the modern translations like the ESV that not all the translations catch that reflects what's going on here, where he says, those who are being saved. Because we speak of our salvation properly three different ways. I look at some of you. I'm not like not sure which one of you are saved. I started to look at Brian and said, "Well, I'm not sure about him." But as Tom, we can say Tom has been saved. Tom is being saved. And Tom will be saved. And all three of those are a New Testament truth. There is a sense in which when Tom repented and gave his heart to Christ, Tom was saved. But that's not all there was to salvation. There is another sense in which God is continually working and molding and shaping Tom's life and making Tom more and more into the image of Christ. And in that regard, Tom is being saved. And there will come a time, whether it is with his glorification by death or when Christ returns, that process of salvation will be complete and he will be saved at that point. And so all three of those tenses are correct. But here he speaks of those of us who are being saved. That is, we're being changed. And as we're being changed, we recognize the power of the cross. Because the power of the cross isn't just the booth where you get your ticket to the Glory Land train. The cross is the place where your life is changed once and for all. It is the beginning of the change. It is the point of no return where we begin our journey of becoming more and more like Christ. That is the power of the cross. And then he uses this wisdom and foolishness theme throughout. The wisdom of God is foolishness to men. The wisdom of men is foolishness to God. But there in verse 24, but to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, he uses two titles, two phrases to describe Christ here. The power of God and the wisdom of God. So when the monks in that stony monastery would sing that chant, O come thou wisdom from on high, and order all things far and nigh. As their Latin-speaking voices would echo off the stone of the monastery, their words are remembering 1 Corinthians 1:24. Jesus Christ, the power of God, and the wisdom of God. Before I go into our final section, I want you to think about how wisdom and power work together. You can have a ruler that is powerful but not wise. You can have a man or a woman that is wise but not powerful. But in God, both meet so that wisdom and power complement one another. Two questions. How does Jesus function as the wisdom of God? How does Jesus function as the wisdom of God? Four ideas. First of all, Jesus is the culmination of the redemptive plan conceived by the wisdom of God. The whole plan of the cross was authored by the wisdom of God. Second, Jesus is the embodiment of God's wisdom. Now, anytime we say God is, and we speak of a virtue, even when we say God is love, we are saying that God is the apex, he is the prime example of love, not that that's all God is. There are more characteristics and attributes to God than simply love. Love is one of those. But if you're looking for the prime example of love, it's God. Same thing with wisdom. God is power and wisdom and holiness and faithfulness and. But as we isolate those and we meditate on the particulars, God, the wisdom of God, God is the great example of wisdom. And as Jesus Christ came to walk this earth, it is the wisdom of God with dirty feet. Number three, Jesus is the model of living in God's wisdom. And four, Jesus is the teacher of God's wisdom. To us, the path of knowledge show and teach us in and cause us in her ways to go. Jesus taught us, he showed us what true wisdom is. Now, our next question, as we get ready to close, is how may we live by God's wisdom? What do we do? It's the so what question. Four ideas to end. Fear God. Fear God's judgment. Proverbs 1 tells us, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. I had no problems with that growing up, because the foundational understanding of my family was the fear of Dad is the beginning of wisdom. You know, there are things that I've got to be careful here. I don't want child services to come after my father. But there were disciplinary actions that he exercised upon my person that caused great fear in me and stirred a desire of obedience. Did I get around that okay? So understand, there's more to God than us just fearing him, but fear's a pretty good place to start. Because he is the one who will judge us. And so we want him to judge us well. Fear his judgment. Not only fear his judgment, learn God's ways. Proverbs chapter 2, which is like a life verse for me, symbolizes wisdom as a hidden treasure and says, do everything you can to pursue her. Like it's a hidden treasure. Do you pursue wisdom? Then not only learn God's way, but pursue God's heart. One of those books that I have read many, many times is entitled Desiring God, written by a pastor named John Piper. We almost named Libby Piper because of him. I figured if I can get a kid named Schaefer, I can get anything done. But alas, Angie drew a line in the sand and said no. But do you desire God? It's kind of like this. As Piper describes our love of God, he talks about some people that their love is defined by duty. And he says, if on my anniversary, I bring my wife flowers, and she says, hey, oh, they're beautiful flowers. And I say, well, it's my duty because it's our anniversary. He said, I don't get a kiss. He said, if I bring her the flowers and she says, oh, thank you for the flowers, they're beautiful. And he says, not a fraction of your beauty. And I can't help myself because you are the love of my life. You absorb my thoughts. He says, I get a kiss. Do you desire God? Does he consume you? I know that we all have love that is imperfect. But is it a love that pursues him? Fear God's judgment. Learn God's ways. Pursue God's heart. Tell God's story. You could say, go tell it on the mountains. But that would be hokey if I were to say that. Hymnists and songwriters are often the poets of doctrine. One of my favorite songwriters is a man by the name of Michael Card. The title of the song will offend you, but you have to see it in the context of 1 Corinthians 1. title of the song is God's Own Fool. Seems I've imagined him all of my life as the wisest of all of mankind. But if God's holy wisdom is foolish to man, he must have seemed out of his mind. Even his family said he was mad, and the priest said a demon's to blame. But God, in the form of this angry young man, could not have seemed perfectly sane. We in our foolishness thought we were wise. He played the fool, and he opened our eyes. We in our weakness believed we were strong. He became helpless to show we were wrong. So we follow God's own fool, for only the foolish can tell. Believe the unbelievable. Come be a fool as well. So come lose your life for a carpenter's son, for a man never died for a dream. And you'll have the faith his first followers had, and you'll feel the weight of the beam. So surrender the hunger to say you must know, and have the courage to say, I believe. For the power of paradox opens your eyes and blinds those who say they can see. So we follow God's own fool, for only the foolish can tell. Believe the unbelievable. Come, be a fool as well. O come, thou wisdom from on high, and order all things far and nigh. To us the path of knowledge show, and cause us in her ways to go.